Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 20th of August. James Galbraith is our guest this hour, holding the Lloyd Benson Chair in E in Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He has written a number of books. He directs the University of Texas Inequality Project, an informal research group at the LBJ School. He's a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute, chair of Economists for Peace and Security, which is a global professional organization, and he has written a number of books. His latest is what we talk about this hour, The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market, and Why Liberals Should Too. We're welcoming phone calls for Professor Galbraith, as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2255. 214-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. Hello, James. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
First sentence is, the book got underway right after Hurricane Katrina, which obviously had a huge impact on you and on the country. Why? What were your thoughts after Katrina?
I just thought that Katrina, in many ways, ripped the scab off of the kind of government that we have acquired, particularly in the present decade, and that it brought many people sort of face to face with the reality that the government was not even attempting to serve their interests.
Mm. Mm-hmm. You talk about the economy in this country as not being a free economy. It's a complex combination of private and public institutions, some of which have failed us pretty miserably. Tell me about what it is.
Well, I think that the U.S. economy over the 20th century is one of the great success stories of all economic history. And the reason is that it avoided the extremes of central planning, centrally planned socialism on the one side, and of completely deregulated, unregulated markets on the other. Instead, what we constructed was, as you say, a complex combination of public and private institutions, which suffuse our economy. They're part of everything that we do. And there's something sort of fundamentally unrealistic about the idea, which is greatly beloved of economics textbooks, that the economy and the government are somehow separate entities and that the government simply intervenes in the economy. Mm-hmm. No, this is not true. The government is an intrinsic part of the economy. It's important in housing and healthcare and education and research and providing security, in setting the rules for every private market that is out there that functions. And when the rulemaking function is taken over by people who are not interested in enforcing rules but in only using them for private profit, then you've got a serious problem. And that's the situation we're in.
Talking about what, people like Blackwater?
Well, certainly Blackwater's an example of outsourcing in the military sector, and one where there's been a lot of criticism because, obviously, the rules that apply to professional soldiers don't apply to private security guards of the Blackwater type, and also the pay scales that professional soldiers live under don't apply to the private security types. And so there's a profound sort of disequilibrium and imbalance mm-hmm. in the relationship between those two entities, and it's a big problem, sure.
Mm-hmm. And play this out about what happened in Katrina. You write about the abuse of public institutions for private profit. There was a lot of private profit associated, and I would imagine it continues to be the case, surrounding Hurricane Katrina.
There was indeed. But what was clear in the first days was that we were witnessing what appeared to be, in many ways, a calculated negligence, an attempt to move very fast to take advantage of the situation. And we have seen since then that the effort that any civilized society would have taken to keep the community of the city of New Orleans together was not taken. People were scattered to the four winds.
Yes.
And that was basically that. And, you know, in some places they landed well, in many other places they struggled very badly. But you had a strong sense that the preservation or reconstruction of the community of that city was not a priority at all. In fact, it was it, quite the reverse.
Mm-hmm. And what about now? There was a great deal of consternation. People were outraged by what they saw. Has that vanished from our consciousness?
I think it has not vanished, no. I think, actually, it was a turning point. Mm. And I say in the book that, Katrina was like the was in some sense the Chernobyl of our system. Mm-hmm. Chernobyl was the explosion at the Soviet nuclear reactor in the Ukraine, which revealed for the people of that country just how badly broken their system actually was. And Katrina had that effect on our psychology. And I think it really put an end to this idea that you can constantly attack the functions of government, that it's okay to turn them over to cronies, which is what happened to the Federal Emergency Management Administration in the Bush years. That agency, by the way, had been built up into something quite effective under President Clinton, totally wrecked under President Bush. The idea that you can do this and get away with it, that there are no serious consequences, was completely blown away at that time. And I don't think we'll go back to that kind of illusion anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. Nobody was ever fired, were they, for all of that?
Some people left their jobs, but there was certainly, I mean, the people who needed to be fired were right at the top of the administration, that's clear.
Right.
We're talking here about a malfunctioning of the federal government, which was part of the philosophy of government under which we've been living.
You talk about, in an area, what should be done, that the U.S. needs a capacity to plan. When I think about what happened post-Katrina, when you think about what happened post-Iraq, when you think of so many areas, you think, what in the world were people thinking? They didn't have a plan at all for what was going to happen after these events.
And perhaps they didn't care.
Really?
Because at some level, perhaps the objective that was served was, in their minds, so overriding that they were prepared to live with whatever consequences followed. And I think that was very largely the case in Iraq. It wasn't as though there were not people in the government who knew and how what a disaster, how difficult this was going to be. The State Department had reams of paper on the subject put together by people who knew the area regionally well. They were not included in the process leading up to the invasion. Their advice was not sought. It was all set aside. It was a waste of time. And so you have to figure, well, for the people who conducted this war, the reasonable inference is that they didn't really care what was going to happen afterwards. Their objective was to destroy the Iraqi regime, which they did, and perhaps they had other objectives long-term about a U.S. presence in the region, a kind of coaling station idea. But as far as the Iraqi state and the Iraqi population was concerned, wasn't something that they were seriously worried about,
mm-hmm.
Let alone the cost to the U.S., let alone the... to give it a very concrete example, this is brought out in work by Joe Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes in their recent book. There was simply no planning for the number of returning veterans who would come home from that war with serious injuries,
mm-hmm.
Something that would require a major scaling up of Veterans Administration services.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, huge backlogs in applications for disability emerged. Why? Well, people weren't putting the pieces together. You have a war in which, because of improvements in medical care, a great many people who would have been killed and would come home in boxes instead come home with severe injuries. They've got to be cared for. That requires thinking about the consequences
yes,
of it,
right.
planning the scale of your operation. It didn't happen.
Yeah. Well, it's astounding to me that we elect people to do just that. That's part of what our government is for, right? And the level of outrage when we saw the conditions that existed at hospitals and the long waiting lines and not getting their benefits explained and being in this morass for months and months and months and months. I mean, it really is a falling apart of government at a very deep level because it's the wrong thing to do. It's wrong. If you're going to have people fighting this, you darn well have to take care of them when they get home.
Well, a philosophy of indifference stems, first of all, from the way in which the 2000 election was resolved. I think that has to be said. A president who was installed by a single vote on the Supreme Court after a very questionable obstruction of the vote count in the key state of Florida in that year, is not leading an administration which is responsive to a popular mandate. And they weren't. They didn't. Whatever his agenda was, it was not an act of political leadership of the entire country. I think that's really fundamental to the kind of government that we've been under. At the same time, because of the extraordinary lack of popularity of the administration, the underlings were extremely sensitive to anything that might make the White House look bad. And so when the civil servants in the Veterans Administration went to the political appointees and said, hey, we've got a problem, they got told to get lost, keep quiet. The White House does not like ugly, was what someone I know was told by a political appointee about budget numbers that they were presenting. And so the reality was basically suppressed for political reasons. And you know, the VA is a major example. This is pervasive across the government. There's nobody home, nobody doing the job. The top functions have been turned over to the lobbies.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about the U.S. needing a capacity to plan, what do you mean by that? What do we need to put in place?
I mean that there is such a thing as the public interest, and there's such a thing as the national interest, and there's such a thing as the interest of the future. And these things are not represented in private markets, which represent the interests of consumers and firms in the present, the desire for profits on the part of firms, the desire for satisfaction on the part of consumers. And those are worthy things. But the interest of someone who is going to be born 20 years from now, who will grow up in a markedly warmer world, or grow up in a world with where petroleum is much less available and much more expensive than it is now, are simply not represented. And so the society needs a capacity to imagine what the future is like, to imagine it autonomously, and to recommend and to act on recommendations about what needs to be done. And we're clearly everybody understands that about climate change, but we haven't got an effective institution in place to really do in detail the kind of work that needs to be done to make sure that we meet the targets that we have to meet.
Mm-hmm. The U.S. needs to come to grips, you write, with a position in the global economy, prepare for the day when unlimited privilege of issuing never-to-be-paid chits to the rest of the world may come to an end. This is a huge area, but take it where you will.
Yeah, sure. People like to hark back to the New Deal, or the Great Society, for that matter, as times when the government engaged in major initiatives. And it's worth remembering that in those days, the U.S. was much more on top of the world economically than we are now. We are now an enormous net debtor. And, you know, that's an advantage in many respects. It means we get to import things without having to pay for them with real exports at the same time. It means, however, that in order for the system to work, other people need to be willing to hold the dollar and U.S. bonds as reserves. And there are two issues here. One is, how safe and sound are our financial markets? That's taken a huge hit under this administration because of an irresponsible attitude toward deregulation, which actually goes back to the previous administration as well. And secondly, is the country doing something which makes it, you know, a good investment, an investment that people are happy to hold? And in the Cold War, we were providing them, by and large, leadership in a grand alliance against expansionary communism. Many people saw the Soviet Union as a threat to their liberties, and we were the bulwark against that. And that gave us a claim on our status. Clearly, since the end of the Cold War, we've been floundering trying to find an equivalent claim. And I think if we're going to find one in the future, it has to be in the area of new technologies aimed at solving the energy and the environmental problems. We have the capacity to do that. If we use that capacity, well, I think the rest of the world will say, great, the United States is doing its job.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Reagan conservative ideas, great conservative economic ideas, if there have been any since then, how he changed the final financial picture in this country. And if there are still some great conservative economic ideas or some great liberal economic ideas.
Well, one of the I obviously came into academic life in the early Reagan period or just before it. And one of the things that was striking about that time was that the body of ideas which was articulated publicly in the Reagan, early Reagan plans, or early Reagan policies plans is not quite the right word, but was a very coherent one. It was and one which had a very strong academic pedigree. People tend to forget, but if you came up through graduate school in those days, you were steeped in the philosophy that the Federal Reserve should be the one inflation fighter, and the government should follow certain fiscal principles. There was a whole discussion about the effect of tax rates on behavior, a whole discussion certainly about the benefits of free trade, a discussion about the costs and benefits of regulation. There was a large academic establishment. So in many ways, the Reagan administration, though I thought it was wrong at the time, I never agreed with it, had a coherent philosophy and people believed in it in good faith. And what's interesting about the last 30 years is, first of all, there's been no development at all of those ideas. The conservatives have simply been stuck on this one theme. And secondly, in practice, none of it worked out. And in practice, a right-wing government, which is what we have, doesn't follow those principles at all. It's not informed by them. They exist as a kind of phantom ideology, which is recited on public occasions, but it isn't part of the way the country is governed. And people who came into the Reagan administration in the early 1980s with high hopes for that agenda are by and large out of government and quite totally disillusioned. Many of them are as actively opposed to the government we presently have as I am. So mm-hmm. It's quite interesting. And I think that from the liberal point of view, the great failing of liberals is to not quite see this, to continue to hold the kind of enthrallment to the Reagan ideas, to this constellation of free market principles, and to constantly bow and scrape before them without recognizing that this is really a diversion which has prevented liberals and progressives from framing answers to the problems that we actually have. And that what the book is an attempt to do is to kind of reframe the debate to say, look, it's not the issue we've got here is a broken government, broken in a very particular way by very particular people, and that's the problem that we need to address and keep focused on.
Mm-hmm. And some of the other problems, global warming, the gap between the rich and poor, the powerhouse of China and India and other nations, and what's that doing to our economy? Can you add to that list?
Well, that's certainly a pretty good start, but there's also the we've had an enormous failure to keep up our investment in basic public infrastructure so that mm-hmm. our roads and our travels, our transportation networks in a state of decay. There's obviously a failure to invest as much as we should in K-12 education. There is, of course, the enormous mess of our healthcare system, which has some aspects which are advantageous. We spend a lot of money on technical progress in this area, but huge gaps in the coverage and the kind of peonage that it results when people have to stay in jobs they don't like because they can't get medical insurance if they leave their jobs. This kind of problem has to be dealt with.
Right. Well, where's all the money going? Is it a lack of money, or is it all going to Iraq, or what's happening?
There's plenty of money. This is a very rich country, and it's a country which has, this enormous financial privilege in the world. It is a failure to organize ourselves to do the work that needs to be done. We have the money. I mean, money is never a constraint. We have the talent. We have the physical capital. We have the scientific capacity. We certainly have the capacity to build public institutions that need to be built to get things done. But it's a political obstacle. The political system is entirely deadlocked because at every level you've got powerful private interests who see an enormous opportunity to profit, basically not by doing market activities, but by piggybacking on the public ones. So you've got drug companies selling into Medicare. You've got student loan companies selling private marketing student loans, that something could be done much more cheaply in the public sector. You had this enormous effort to privatize Social Security. Mm-hmm. Why did they want to do that? Well, fund managers would get their hands on a huge cash flow, and they would be able to earn very fat fees marketing investments to middle class and working class people. Stockbrokers would get in on this act. This was a calculated effort to channel resources which are presently public into private hands, and that is, in some sense, the essence of the policies that we've seen in so many areas.
Yeah. Phone calls for you in just a moment. We're talking with the author of The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. James K. Galbraith is our guest, and he is the Lloyd Benson Chair in Government Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He's written several other books, and we're welcoming calls for him at 800-486-8655. Other books of his include Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay, Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future. And his columns and articles appear frequently in Mother Jones, The American Prospect, The Nation, The Texas Observer, among many others, and in many academic journals. Lines are filled, so just keep trying. You'll get through eventually. Or if you want to send an email, we will read some of those. That's talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's get to phone calls now. Jim from Mellon is our first caller. Hi, Jim.
Oh, good morning. I'd like to make, two major points here. First of all, though, let me just say that I have my four-year degree in economics from the University of Madison, just as background here. I think there's two major problems here with the direction of American corporations in the government. And my number one point is that since all the battles we had in the 1960s, the educational elite, academia, has basically taken over the governance of the American form of government and of business. And this is a very bad sort of thing. There's basically a few schools, you know, like Harvard, Yale, Columbia, et cetera, where the big leaders of both the political parties mostly have their degrees and educational backgrounds from. And just as an example, before this happened in the banking industry, you'd start as a teller and work your way up through the banking hierarchy, and by the time you had 30 years of experience in banking at every level of the institution, then maybe you'd be a vice president or president. But now what they're doing is these big outfits like Citibank in New York that have been engaged in such enormous amounts of corrupt practices, they'll get some CEO who has his degree in business from Harvard, someplace like that. These people just are not competent to run the real world. And the same is true of the government. This guy that was running the agency that made all those blunders during Katrina, I'll bet you $1 million that guy was a lawyer trained at someplace like Harvard. My second point is that because the Clinton administration pushed through NAFTA, which is kind of a rubric for all these other trade treaties they shoved through principally with the country of China, we're facing what could be a major economic debacle right now. And it has to do with the economic principle of balancing as it's used in international trade usage. And what this means is that traditionally in America, when we've had inflation in prices of goods and services like we've had recently, usually that doesn't become damaging inflation unless the same thing happens with a wage spiral. And when that happens, then inflation can really get out of control in America, really be damaging to American families. But at least the working people who got wage increases were protected from that inflation to some degree. But because of the NAFTA treaty, we're now seeing inflation caused in America by the increase in prices of Chinese goods imported into the United States in huge quantities, and also inflationary pressures are building in China amongst the working people in China. You know, we're talking a billion people in China getting inflationary wage increases, and that is going to reverberate back into the United States, so the international trade system set up by NAFTA.
All right, I need to hold you there because we have a lot of people who want to talk to
you. Okay, let me make three points. First of all, I have having degrees from both Harvard and Yale, I hate to confess. I share your skepticism about putting people from those universities in charge of the country, and particularly the financial sector. Secondly, I really hope you've got that $1 million because while you were talking, I looked up Michael Brown of FEMA, and it does turn out apparently that his law degree was from the University of Oklahoma City University School of Law.
Oh, really?
So just incidentally. What is, I think, particularly interesting about your final point on the return of inflation is that when you track it back, it is, I think, closely connected to the same kinds of financial manipulation that you were talking about at the beginning of your intervention. What we're talking about, what's happening in China, is largely the consequence of increases in oil and grain prices. What is causing the increase of oil and grain prices? I have a column out in Mother Jones that's published on Monday talking about the role of financial market speculation, which took off in this area in the last couple of years. Why? One important reason was that the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which is supposed to be regulating this area, particularly oil futures, punted and started allowing trades in U.S. Energy futures to be conducted as though they were regulated by the Financial Services Administration of the United Kingdom, even though those trades were actually occurring here in the United States. And a huge amount of the futures market trading, more than half now, according to the CFTC itself, of futures market trading in energy is being conducted by non-commercial players, that is to say, by people who are basically companies that are basically speculating.
Mm-hmm.
This is something which explains why prices in all of these commodities, oil, grain, base metals like copper, going up at once. There's, it seems to me, very plainly a major financial manipulation going on, and this is feeding back through the mechanisms you described, that those higher prices in China coming into goods in the United States, into everything that American working families buy.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting, very important problem. The roots of it are in the instability of the financial sector.
Mm. Do you want to talk a little, because I know that the book has more of this, on NAFTA trade agreements and also whether or not there should be some kinds of sanctions against China when it comes to human rights?
China is a very big country, and it's a country where I think we should be talking to them always about the human rights cases that concern us. Implying sanctions to them is not going to be a productive strategy. I know a lot about China. I've been there many times. One has to work with what works. I think they will listen to us when we have come in good faith with cases that concern us. But a carrot policy is simply, well, it's a very proud country with a very proud government. It's not going to be an effective strategy because obviously they look at us and say, hey, who are you to talk?
Right.
The question of NAFTA is really a vexed question because NAFTA has become kind of a toxic code word for everything that's gone wrong with American manufacturing. But I think the reality is that the great disaster that befell American manufacturing was long before NAFTA. It occurred at the start of the Reagan administration with the actions, notably of the Federal Reserve, Paul Volcker's Federal Reserve, raising interest rates to 20%, pushing the dollar up by 60%, collapsing the international markets of firms all across the upper Midwest, including a great many firms in Milwaukee. I was working for a great congressman from Milwaukee in those days, Congressman Henry Royce.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah, I know. Henry was my great mentor in my early part of my career.
I didn't know that.
I absolutely loved him. He's
And we watched as the Milwaukee businesses, Alice Chalmers was a Milwaukee business,
mm-hmm, sure.
Went down at that time. This was something that long predated NAFTA. And I think, you know, NAFTA is kind of a punctuation mark on this period of industrial decline that was set in motion by policies put in place in the United States.
Hmm. Thanks, Jim, so much for your call. Let's go next to Rich from Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Thanks. Here's my observation. The Republicans I grew up around created jobs, and they created jobs in this nation for their countrymen under immense tax burdens by today's standards. They were extremely proud of putting people to work. All economies are always and everywhere planned, and the question is, who is doing the planning and for whose purposes? American corporations chasing cheap labor around the world are basically ruining this economy, and fortunately for me and for you, we have two good friends. We have the testimony of Dwight David Eisenhower, who said, beware of the military-industrial complex because it will redefine who you are as Americans. And we have our friend Tom Jefferson, who said the basis of our governments is the opinion of the people, and the opinion of the people is somewhere in the 75 to 80% range, saying the nation is headed in the wrong direction. I really think that your book, books by people like, I think his name is David Schweikert, After Capitalism, out of the University of Chicago, and After Capitalism, it isn't communism, it's a participatory kind of workplace decision-making that he advocates. People have to wake up that things are being planned, but they're not being planned for our benefit as American citizens.
Quite right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Rich, very much for your call. Let's go to Bob from Eau Claire next. Hi, Bob.
Hello. There are a lot of problems out there that you were discussing, and I love what the last caller said, but I was calling basically to find out what are the solutions, what are the fixes when it seems to me if it's all policy-driven, our government basically ignoring the best interests of the public, energy being an example, Katrina, Iraqi veterans. We have two candidates that are out there through primaries that have been ignoring the public interest, and the best way to describe that is, you know, Democrats who you thought probably wouldn't want to go nuclear or going nuclear, that they didn't want coal, going to do coal, that didn't want offshore drilling, going to do offshore drilling, and it's really upsetting. I mean, what I want to hear is what the solution is. What should we do in this election? Because, I mean, I hate to say this, but I don't want to vote for either one.
Well, I guess I beg to differ. I recognize and agree with you on the substance of some of the comments you just made about coal and offshore drilling, although I think what Barack Obama said about offshore drilling was qualified. The reality is this is, in my view, a watershed election. In the Republican candidate, with all respect for him, we have a former chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee, a man whose entire career has been tightly tied up in the lobbyist culture of Washington D.C., in the culture of passing out favors. It's a guy who's got professional lobbyists on his campaign bus doing their lobbying business from the bus. It's well known. It was well known in the primaries that was going on. I'm not going to make out the Democratic candidate Barack Obama as a saint, but I think we have a very clear sense of a need for a change of direction in the Democratic Party this year. It's been that Senator Obama has articulated that very clearly, and he has at least
brought into focus some of the major goals, including energy and environment, energy and climate change, that we need to be working on for the long term. He's spoken, I think, also very effectively about the need to get funding into our public capital investment, rebuild infrastructure. The short-term management of the economy, I think, would be basically different under Obama than under McCain. No administration is going to turn the country around on a dime, but I think that this election has the potential to really set us on a new path, and that's at least the optimist within me speaking on that point.
Why do you think this election, and I don't know, it's hard to tell where it is, but why do you think it's so close, James?
I'm not at all surprised that it's close.
Really?
I mean, first of all, John McCain is trying very hard to shed the incubus of George W. Bush. He is not, obviously, an official of the Bush administration.
Right.
It's possible for him to try to obscure the fact that he's been a very close ally of Bush's, and particularly on foreign policy matters. And you can watch his ads during the Olympics where he basically attacked the Bush administration. It's a very disingenuous thing for the guy to do, attacking his own record. But there he was. So I think that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is that the country has been relatively evenly divided for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Since the erosion of the Reagan supermajorities in the early 1980s, this has been a country of close elections. I do think the Republican Party as a whole is in bad odor, and the previous caller pointed out to this. That people in the Midwest and the Northeast and the Far West and increasingly in the Southwest don't recognize the Republican Party anymore as being the one they knew. And so anybody who runs on the Republican ticket has to kind of establish themselves as an unconventional figure.
Hmm.
And that was true of McCain. It would have been mm-hmm. true of Giuliani, of Romney, of any number of people. It's still possible for the guy who is not the Democrat to run a close race.
Right. More phone calls in a moment. We're speaking this hour with James Galbraith, who's written a very important book, I think, The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. He, of course, is a big name. He holds the Lloyd Benson Chair in Government Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Degrees from Harvard and Yale. Studied economics as a Marshall Scholar at King's College, Cambridge, and then served on the staff of the U.S. Congress, including as Executive Director of the Joint Economic Committee. He directs the University of Texas Inequality Project. He's a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and chair of Economists for Peace and Security, a global professional association. He's also written many other books. More phone calls momentarily, 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee, or send an email if you'd like. Nobody's done that this hour, but there it is, so use it if you'd like. You can't get through. The email is available to you at talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your phone calls now, and Amy from Mercer. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am camping, and I had to stop and run into the truck to make this phone call. And it's appropriate right now because I'm a teacher, and I will be going back to school in a couple of weeks. And I just really, this conversation really resonates with me. I've seen what the private sector has been doing to public education since the Bush administration, since Bush signed in No Child Left Behind. It opened up public money that should be going to educating children to testing companies. And there's an enormous amount of talk of accountability and blame on schools and teachers based on these test scores. and no one really is questioning no one's holding the testing companies accountable for producing fair and appropriate and developmentally appropriate tests. And so, to me, I mean, the amount of money we're spending, I teach in Milwaukee Public Schools, and my students, 8 years old, take 6 standardized tests a year. When I first started teaching, right when the law was signed, that wasn't happening. And now I just feel like we are doing wrong by our children, and the money could be spent in ways that would help children. Now all of that money is going towards these companies. Computer companies are producing test prep programs. We're spending all of this money, but we're losing art teachers, we're losing reading specialists, we're losing social workers, we don't have a school nurse. And it just seems like the public is being wronged. Mm. And so I just had to call. I really appreciate the book and this conversation, and thank you so much, and I'll take your comments.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for your call.
All I can say is amen. Tell me about it. I have 2 daughters in the public schools here in Austin, Texas. One of them is now 11. The other one is 6. And we have just exactly the experience that the caller was describing here, in which the educational climate has been constantly and persistently reoriented toward these dreadful tests, which completely undermine the support that the school would otherwise give to the non-tested subjects, to the art and music and so forth, and which also, teachers work valiantly to try and educate in this context, but they are obliged to spend an enormous amount of time on mind-numbing drills. And what's going on here? Part of the political agenda here, bear in mind, is that at the start of this administration, there was a great push for vouchers. Vouchers to basically work to defund the public school system, to support the creation of charter schools and schools which would have an agenda that was not regulated by the public school authorities in particular districts. That failed. The American public wasn't very interested in it. They didn't want their kids going to storefront schools run by fringe religious groups or what have you. And so it just didn't get off the ground. The testing program works to discredit the public schools, in many cases very unfairly. Schools which serve transient communities, which have a lot of migrants, a lot of immigrants, a lot of English as a second language kids tend to do very poorly. They come under enormous pressure because their test scores are low. And then of course people say, oh well, who wants to send your kid to a school with a low test score, or for that matter to a school where the educational values are being so heavily influenced, even perverted, I would say, by this teach to the test mentality. And so again, the hope on the part of this crusade for privatization is that this will bring back support for voucherization and other schemes of that kind later on. This is not the way to go with public education in America. I think the caller was exactly right.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, isn't it, James, that if you talk to teachers, I have yet to meet one who isn't concerned about this. They really have deep concerns about not being able to teach whole units, be it on a certain aspect of history, on all kinds of different subjects, because they're getting kids prepared to take the multiple choice tests.
Teachers are professionals. They have great values. They're doing this job for pathetically low pay in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
What they cling to is their ability to educate. And of course they're going to be upset when that ability is being subverted in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying there shouldn't be evaluation, there shouldn't be accountability. There is a kind of check and balance between the school district and the state education authority, and for that matter, the federal government. But turning everything into a teach-to-the-test routine and then radically defunding schools, which may be low-scoring for reasons that really have nothing to do with the quality or the dedication of the teachers, is extremely poor and dangerous and destructive policy.
Scott from Green Bay, hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
Boy, there's so many different subjects you could talk about, and I'll stay off the school subject. The question I had, and the thing that I like to propose is, and I hear a lot how conservatives and Republicans are to blame basically for the problems the country has. All the ills of the country can be at the feet of either George Bush or the Republicans in general. And my opinion has been from 1960 to 2000, those 40 years span, and these problems have been building. This is something that has just not occurred in the last 8 years under the Bush administration. We've got systematic problems that have been building for a long time. 34 out of the 40 years, the Democrats controlled the House. I think 36 out of the 40 years, the Democrats controlled the Senate. 20 out of the 40 years, the Democrats controlled the White House. They really systematically have been ingrained in Washington far more than the Republicans have. I think we can lay some blame at the Democrat administrations that have caused some of these problems. We can't always say it's Republicans when the Democrats really have controlled the situation. The other comment you made about the increase in the dollar and the incredibly high interest rates causing problems from Paul Volcker and the Reagan administration, maybe I'm incorrect, but I think it was the Carter administration where Volcker started that, because I can remember a conversation between Paul Volcker and Jimmy Carter exactly regarding high interest rates, and Carter just didn't seem to get the economic picture. So I think you can't say it was the Reagan administration. I think that really started in the Carter administration.
Paul Volcker was indeed appointed by Jimmy Carter. The period of high interest rates that really upset the apple cart for the American industrial sector started under the Reagan administration in January, February of 1981. So, but yes, you're right. Paul Volcker was indeed appointed in the late Carter administration in a moment of panic over the decline of the dollar in 1979. What you say about Democrats and Republicans being jointly complicit, I totally agree with. And I have to say, a major thesis of the book is not aimed at conservatives, and particularly not at philosophical conservatives, who in many ways share my analysis of the way the government has actually been run. It's aimed at liberals who have been pusillanimous, who have not maintained the ability to develop their own analysis. And that's what they need to have if they're going to have policies that are worth anything. If liberals are simply me too behind an ideological smokescreen that was set up 30 years ago but really bears very little resemblance to the way policy is actually made, then they're not going to be worth very much.
Thanks, Scott, so much for your call. Sharon is next from Duluth. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. Recently, you had a guest on that wrote the book The Wrecking Crew. Are you familiar with that?
Tom Frank.
My question was, it does feel like there has been intentional spending, this drown the government in the bathtub, make it so small. And you said there's plenty of money. So my question is, you know, how would we get that money? Because my feeling with the author of The Wrecking Crew is that so much has been spent that we aren't going to have the money to make the changes that we want to do in a lot of ways.
You know, there's no money is something which is just created for the purposes of the society that creates it. It's an accounting identity. A friend of mine says no bowling alley ever ran out of points, had to shut down because there weren't enough points to award when people got too many strikes. And money is exactly the same sort of thing. It's a scorekeeping device. It's not a constraint. What is a constraint is how we organize ourselves, how we distribute the money, for what purposes, whether we have the capacity to do things that need to be done. We build that capacity then and take those actions. I think two things will happen. First of all, we won't have we'll actually solve some of the problems. And secondly, the rest of the world will continue to hold U.S. Treasury bonds, and we will continue to have a very high and comfortable living standard. If we don't do those things, you know, we can run into a lot of problems, not because of shortage of money, but because people who control the prices of things we consume, notably oil, will continue to gouge us for the privilege of consuming it.
Thank you, Sharon, so much for your call. Well, that was a great hour. Thanks, James, so much for being with us and for Every now and then somebody writes a book and you think, oh, this is different and important, and it's a good one. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it very much.
James Galbraith, his book is The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. He has written several other books, and he is now the Lloyd Benson Chair in Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin, holding degrees from Harvard and Yale, studied economics as a Marshall Scholar at King's College in Cambridge, and then served on the staff of the U.S. Congress. He evidently served with Henry Royce for some time, including as executive director of the Joint Economic Committee. He directs the University of Texas Inequality Project. He's a senior scholar of the Levy Economics Institute and chair of Economist for Peace and Security. He's also the author of Created Unequal, The Crisis in American Pay and Balancing Acts, Technology, Finance, and the American Future. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. For your calls, everybody, we thank you as well. I think our email is down, so if you tried to get through, I'm sorry, we'll save them. Maybe they'll go for another show, huh? Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.